very glad to be home. This has been a year of a lot of travel, but especially these 2 3-month retreats, which were for me, 2 100-day retreats, was a lot of time away, extremely meaningful. But I had this strong kind of resolve and anticipation that although this year I would make whatever sacrifice needed to be present, to be guiding people in meditations for these 2 retreats, if they went well, if there was really benefit, then I would love to do this in the future, but near my hometown. And so that is the vision. If you don't mind, I always like to just start with a little bit of meditation anyway. Just to settle a little bit, just for a couple of minutes. And maybe you give you at least, if not a taste, at least the aroma of some of the practices we are all doing during these 2 retreats. So let's just sit quietly for a moment. You may close the eyes. And let your awareness slip into the field of tactile sensations. From the soles of your feet to the crown of the head. And simply be aware of whatever tactile sensations arise within this field. And note especially your breathing, that you release fully in body and in mind, with each out-breath. Releasing all the way through the end of the out-breath until the inhalation flows in of its own accord, effortlessly, like the tide. With each out-breath, release any involuntary thoughts, memories, mental images. Release them, let them flutter away and dissolve into the space of the mind as you allow your awareness to come to rest quietly in this field of the body, this field of tactile sensation. And let's bring this very short session to a close. Gently open the eyes. And we begin. That's good. The Shamatha Project has quite a long history. I was first trained in this range of meditative practices designed to make the mind, set the mind at ease, bring about a sense of calm, of presence, of inner serenity, of focus, but also just the opposite of slipping into a kind of trance-like state. Rather slipping into a state of increasing wakefulness, vigilance, alertness. So I was trained in this for the first time when I was studying in Dharamsala, India, in the early 70s. And I was exposed to a wide variety of theories and practices in Tibetan Buddhism, and I was being taught as if I was a Tibetan. So there was like major culture shock as I was exposed to this. And as gradually as the years went over, then it started to make more and more sense. But one thing that leapt out at me in my very early training, as just making enormously good sense from any perspective, was the training in shamatha, the focusing, the development of attention. And I said, whatever else, that is definitely, that's worth doing. So I was very drawn to that from the very beginning. And after 10 years of a lot of training through the 70s, then went off and spent about 4 years in a series of meditative retreats, most of them solitary. Went back finally after 14 years out of Western civilization, finished my undergraduate degree in physics, and then I just went back into retreat again. But during these years when I was in Amherst College and then traveling to the West Coast, actually up to Seattle, I was thinking how meaningful it could be to set up a one-year group retreat, a shamatha retreat. And I let the word out in a Dharma talk very much like this, very, very similar. And a couple of people said, good idea, let's do that. And so we did. I organized it, and we invited over an utterly marvelous Tibetan yogi by the name of Genlam Rinpa, very much my senior, one of my very beloved and revered teachers. He'd spent about, at that time, maybe 25 years in solitary retreat. So I felt, let him be the teacher for this retreat. I'll be his intern, I'll be his assistant, but bring the master from the Himalayas. So we brought him there, and I had just come out of about a nine-month period of solitude up in the Eastern Sierras. And then I joined with him beginning of 1988, so almost 20 years ago. And this was a lot of preparation. 12 people just put their lives on hold, devoted themselves to meditation, a group meditation retreat for 1 year under his guidance. And then I was, again, his intern, his assistant, his translator. And even then, for that one, I thought, how interesting it would be to have some type of monitoring of what happens when people meditate 8, 10, 12, 14 hours a day for a whole year. What happens? They will know what happens. And then when I'm speaking with them, I'll get some idea. Genlam Rinpa, being their primary teacher, he got a very good idea. But what would that look like scientifically? And I'd already gotten to know quite a renowned scientist who'd studied meditation. At that time, he was one of the very few, Herbert Benson at Harvard. When I was at Amherst College, I met him. He came out to see me at Amherst. And when he heard about the shamatha retreat back in 88, he said, can I come? That is, not to be in the retreat, but he was very eager to come and study these very odd people, you know, that would want to meditate for a whole year. And he had done good research on the relaxation response. Some of you might know his book that came out like 25 years ago. But I really felt, this is Genlam Rinpa's retreat. I've organized it. I've worked all the people to arrange this, but he's the teacher. And so I simply brought this to him. I said, there's Harvard scientist, MD, very open-minded, very interested in meditation. He would like to do some monitoring, some measures of our 12 retreatants here. What do you think, boss? Should we allow this? But it's your call. Whatever you decide, that goes. And Genlam Rinpa had not had a lot of exposure to Western civilization. In fact, his exposure to Western civilization was pretty much me. Because I'd spent about 6 months, a bit shy of 6 months in solitary retreat right near his cabin. And so that's when he met his first gringo, that he could actually speak with, because I was fluent in Tibetan. So he got to know me, and so I was Western civilization for him. He had a very steep learning curve when he was in this country. Not everybody's as weird and oddball as I am. But he thought this over very carefully, and he said, scientific studies be very interesting, but we don't know how much impact there would be on the meditators by having the scientists hooking them up and asking questions and maybe doing other kinds of measurements. How much will that impact and possibly detract from their meditative practice? We don't know that. So he said, it would be interesting. Let's not do it now. For this first one, he's already thinking ahead, for this first one, this one-year retreat, small number of people, just a dozen, let's leave out the science. And let's just see what happens when 12 Western meditators plunk down and really devote themselves to practice, leave out the science, but then we'll know what it's like without science. And then, mañana, sometime in the future, you want to do another one, then you can do science then. So that was almost 20 years ago. So this was in my mind for more than 20 years. how meaningful it could be in so many ways to do a study like this and then have just cutting edge, absolutely state-of-the-art scientific measures of a nice richness, diversity, whole range of measures. So that was just percolating. And I collaborated with scientists, neuroscientists for a long time. And I would drop it out there once in a while and say, you know, I've had this idea for a shamatha project. And they say, interesting. And they'd walk away. So this went on for years and years and years. But back in 1992, just to give you a little bit more history, and then we'll jump right into the project. In 1992, from 1990 to 1992, we'd had two Mind and Life conferences. These are meetings with His Holiness the Dalai Lama, with top-notch scientists. And so in 1990, we raised this issue with Richard Davidson, with Francisco Varela, our late and very dear friend, with Cliff Saron, Greg Simpson, and then I. And we thought, why don't we as a team, and I would be the cultural liaison, the interpreter and so forth, the guy who knows Buddhism, why don't we do a study of Tibetan yogis? So we did a study back in 1992. We hiked up into the hills with all of our equipment up into the Himalayas, up above Dharamsala. We found yogis that would actually collaborate with us and be willing to put on EEG caps and so forth. And that was a whole story. That could be an evening, but I won't go there. But I got to know these scientists very well, and Cliff Saron especially, at that time. And so that, again, was more seeds. And then the years went by. I did my doctorate at Stanford, and then I kept on mentioning, you know, every year or two I'd mention, well, there could be a shamatha project. And about 5 years ago, I mentioned it to Cliff Saron, very, very bright, cognitive neuroscientist, and his special area of research is attention. He does multiple things. He does also autism. But attention was a very keen interest of his. And I mentioned it to him, and his eyes lit up and said, good idea. So he went back to his academic home base, University of California at Davis, and he started talking about it with his colleagues there, and some of them very, very eminent scientists. Ron Mangan, the director of the Center for Mind and Brain at UC Davis, Dr. Philip Shaver, the chair of psychology at Davis, and then other just really outstanding psychologists and neuroscientists. And the momentum started to grow, thinking, that is so weird. You know, the scientists think. And we were thinking at that time of doing a one-year retreat. And the scientists were into it. They said, good, let's have a bunch of people meditate for a year. Let's go for it. And we had a meeting at MIT in 2003. And at that point, I remember it very clearly, at that point, the head scientist there at UC Davis, they went public. And they said, we're backing this thing. So Ron Mangan, with a whole Center for Mind and Brain, a very prestigious center at UC Davis, he said, we're doing the Shamatha Project. Philip Shaver sent out a message to all of his professors and all the graduate students in this very large psych department and said, we're doing the Shamatha Project. Once you make it public, you don't go back. And so the ball really started rolling slowly, but it was really rolling in 2003. And then my task was to find a suitable place for it and then find out whether anybody would actually want to sign up for such a thing. And then science, as any of you who are scientists, you know good science is very expensive. And so we were thinking of a one-year retreat, and that would have been, for the science, over $2 million to do a decent study, all the data analysis. But a major catch here, just for room and board, we never found any place that would be cheaper than about $60 a night for room and board, for a single room and three meals a day. I looked and looked and looked. Basically no place for less than $55, $60 a night. Well, if you go for a weekend retreat, three times 60, well, most of us can afford that. Now I'm going to multiply 60 by 360, 365, and you're looking at 20 grand. So now to be a serious meditator, going to retreat for a year, and that's just room and board, it's 20 grand just up front. That could be a little bit deterring for people. And then the scientists would have to raise over 2 million. So we went to the Fetzer Institute, which has been a benefactor for a lot of research and writing I've done over many years, and they just do marvelous work that is just a bit too out of the mainstream for the government or Ford Foundation, Rockefeller Foundation to support. And they actually hired an outside team of very objective evaluators of our whole proposal. And we had a big kind of a summit meeting at UC Davis. So the Fetzer group came in, and their hired guns came in to evaluate, you know, the assessors. And then our whole team showed up, and we had a marvelous day. It was just a marvelous day. And Cliff Saron showed the whole scientific side. I showed the whole meditative side. And everybody in the room, including this outside objective group to assess our work, and then the whole team at UC Davis, they said, you know, You should really do a one-year retreat. It's a fantastic idea, but not now. It's too expensive. It's biting off too much too soon. People can't afford $20,000. We don't have $2 million. Fetzer said, we're not going to give you $2 million. We love this project. In fact, they sought me out when they heard about it. They said, hey, you know, you need some help? So you really like it when foundations do that. But they said, it's too much. Why don't you go for something more modest? Why don't you go for 3 months? And then do it absolutely top drawer science. And that is not just have a bunch of people go off and meditate for 3 months or a year, but now do it in impeccable science. And that is have a control group. And then we had dozens and dozens of hours of discussion. What kind of control group? And for scientists, you know, there's a wide variety you can choose from. After many, many hours of discussion with many people, we decided on what's called a waitlist crossover control group. And that means you have two groups, roughly the same number. You randomly select them, but they're all self-selected in the sense that they have the time and the ability, aspiration to engage in a three-month retreat where they put their whole lives on hold, they quit their jobs or get a leave of absence, and they can't have strong family ties, they can't have small children, you don't leave your children for 3 months. So they're very self-selective. And who would want to go off and, you know, watch their breath for 3 months? That's definitely self-selective. And so we sent out the message. We found a fellow that head of marketing at Shambhala Mountain Center in northern Colorado. He heard about this from a little article that was published in a Buddhist journal. And he contacted me and said, this is a really cool project. Would you like us to host it at Shambhala Mountain Center? You love it when people do that. And I said, well, let's talk. And so we talked, and it turned out to be really the best place for it. I would have loved to do it here, right near Santa Barbara. There just wasn't any place that was feasible, you know, that had that kind of facility and the food and all of that. We talked and talked, and then when we saw, okay, we'll do it there at Shambhala Mountain Center, then they put their whole muscle behind also promoting this, sending out to their newsletter group, their email list, and then we publicized in various journals. But frankly, we're all taking this enormous risk. The scientists didn't know what they're getting into, you know, because they're not meditators. I didn't know whether anybody would really sign up. You know, we'd go through all this effort and then maybe have 10 people sign up, and then half of them would be not suitable. But we'd say, let's just try it, you know. And so we sent out the message. 150 people applied to do this, and we had to charge them. We didn't charge them anything for instruction. Instruction was all free, and they got paid $20 an hour for all of the time that they spent engaging in the measurements, writing their journals. In fact, we have at least one person here who is in the retreat. Journaling every single day. 150 people applied. And then we had a psychologist screen every single person to see, do you have enough meditative background? Are you psychologically fit for this? This is going to be contemplative boot camp. This is not going to be easy. You'll be expected to meditate 8, maybe 10, 12 hours a day. Are you ready for this? And then we asked everybody who wants to consider coming on this retreat, come and have at least one retreat with me. If you need to, you know, you need to know who your teacher is for 3 months. Maybe the chemistry is no good. Maybe I just don't teach in a style you like. Maybe I do, but you need to know before you come and make a three-month commitment. So we went through all of this, and out of 150 people, we chose 70. And they were broken up into two groups, 37 in the first retreat starting in early February, and 33 in the second group starting in early September. And that's how this all started. And there we go. So the scientists, this was just like a candy store for the scientists. Because here we could really grapple with issues that are very important, whether you're a Buddhist, a Christian, you're religious or secular, you're Eastern or Western, it didn't matter from so many perspectives. The questions here are so crucial. Any of you who might be educators, scientists, people in the mental health care profession, people in business, people in areas of creativity, the arts, music, and so forth. Is this an interesting question? Can attention per se be trained? In the year 2003, I was co-leading a panel with John Cohen from Princeton University, one of the top cognitive neuroscientists in the country. His area of specialization is attention. And he and I got to know each other quite well. We're co-leading this panel in this big meeting with the Dalai Lama at MIT. And he told me, we don't have an answer to that question. Is there such a thing as attention? And of course, in a way, of course, we all know that. But there's attention for your backhand. There's attention for video games. There's attention for teaching. There's attention for flying an airplane. is attention. You not have anything called attention, but you have 1,000 attentions, all of them locked into a particular skill. It's a possibility. So you can be very good at video games and not know how to drive a car. Or you can drive a car but have no attention, you know. So is it riveted into a particular skill? So all you're developing is always attention vis-a-vis a skill? Or can you stand back and actually cultivate attention per se on something completely that has no market value, like following your breath? You know, I haven't heard of a job yet that says, we'll pay you $60 an hour to follow your breath. I haven't heard of such a job. You know, so this is a completely non-marketable skill. But if you develop it here, or you're attending to the full body awareness, in mindfulness of breathing, and you do develop some real attention skills, can you, and this is the first question, can you take the attention you've cultivated in that way and then apply it to your relationship with your spouse, raising your child? In the classroom, can you apply this to teaching? If you're a student, can you now attach those attention skills and apply them to study, to creativity, or if you're a musician, in business, planning ahead, making business scheme and so forth? As an architect, can you take that and envision a building, you know, on the floor plan of a building, using your attention skills here? They don't have an answer to this question. That's very basic. And when John Cohen told me this in 2003, I thought, wow, you know so much about attention, but you know so little about the plasticity of attention. That's an enormous question for education, for ADHD, for preventing and maybe treating ADHD. The ramifications are enormous. But in the shamatha project, shamatha simply means, again, the genre of practice for developing attention skills, it wasn't just all about developing attention. I felt, having meditated for more than 3 years in solitary practice already, I thought, if that's all they do, there'd be something a little bit austere about that, a little bit too dry. I know what it's like to spend 8-12 hours a day in meditation with basically no stimuli, no entertainment, no nothing coming, and just all dredging your psyche and bringing forth to consciousness many impulses, desires, emotions, memories, fantasies that are normally latent, really deep down. You go into solitude, it's rather like a little bit like a sensory deprivation tank. That which is unconscious starts to be more and more conscious. And so all kinds of emotions can come up. And I thought people could really do, together with the shamatha practices, a cultivation of the heart, a cultivation of empathy, cultivation of loving kindness. Something really to nurture the heart and to be able to maintain, almost as if you're a sailor, being able to maintain, you know, to trim your sails so you're never keeling over, but be aware, be sensitive to the different winds coming in. And so then being sensitive to that, then trim that sail, hoist this sail and so forth, steer this way, steer that, so you're always maintaining your equilibrium. How helpful it would be to have practices to sustain emotional equilibrium as a complement to these very deep attention training. So can emotion regulation and emotional balance, that can be trained. Emotional regulation, that something happens, adversity strikes, or you're with somebody that gets in a really bad mood, or you get really sick, or just life happens. Can you regulate your emotions, or are you simply a victim of your emotions? Are you simply, as Paul Ekman, a very dear friend of mine who's a world expert on emotions, are you simply in the grip of your emotions? Or can you regulate them? Almost like in driving a car, can you regulate the RPMs on the car? Or does it just go? And you see, oh, 6,000 RPMs. Oh, 7,000 RPMs. Oh, my engine's burning up. Oh. Or can you actually throttle down and do some regulation there? So a normal issue, and then emotional balance, just being able to not fall into extremes of kind of like an inner deadness, a coldness, an aloofness. So, or also not just being so hypersensitive that the emotions are flying all over the place with every little gust of breeze that comes along in life. Can it be? Well, clearly, psychiatrists, psychotherapists, some people then working in affective psychology definitely do have some answers here, but so much more can be known. That would be very interesting. What is the relationship between the two? If you are cultivating these qualities of heart, empathy, loving kindness, compassion, you're cultivating attention skills, a deeper sense of stillness, a focus of continuity and coherence of attention. Do these dovetail? Do they support each other? Are they working at, you know, contrary to each other? What's the relationship between them? Scientists were fascinated by this issue. And then, are these abilities related to or manifest, here's one of these wonderful technical terms that psychologists love, pro-social attitudes. Yes, I like being pro-social. This means being nice. Being a nice person, kind, decent. But we call it pro-social. It sounds much, so much more professional. Pro-social attitudes, like you like people, and decisions, pro-social decisions. The decisions we're making, the choices we're making are actually benevolent, helpful to other people, helpful to ourselves. So are they related to? So enormously important questions. And this, the beauty of the Shamatha Project and these practices themselves is, again, hardly any of the scientists in the team are religious. Most of them are hardcore materialists. I mean, that's pro forum for that discipline in neuroscience. Hardly any have any real interest in Buddhism. It's fine by me. We're not here to validate Buddhism or anything like that. But they're fascinated by these questions. And they thought having a group of people, 70 people, in two groups meditating for anywhere between 84 and 98 days, and doing these practices, that would be really interesting. So that's where these are the questions the scientists brought to this, and they're already thinking about education, mental health, a myriad of areas that are enormously relevant. Here's a very brief overview. We'll go into a bit more in detail. But what was I offering them? Because I was the resident instructor for both of these, of course. And so with the meditative training and the shamatha was cultivating these three qualities at the top: relaxation of body, mind. And then attentional stability, which is not simply an inner stillness, but it's rather a coherence, a cohesiveness, a collectedness, an integration of attention that you can sustain over time. So whatever you wish to attend to, you maintain it, and it doesn't get fragmented, distracted, agitated, flipping out, but maintains an ongoing flow of sanity. And sanity has the etymology, going back to the Latin, I believe, of wholeness. That if you're engaging in a conversation, you're wholly present with the other person. You're wholly present when they're speaking. You're utterly attentive to what they're saying. And not just the words, as if you're a tape recorder. You're attending to the body language, to tone of voice, facial expression, the speed with which a person is speaking, and of course the content. Dear friend of mine, I just had a lovely conversation with him just a few days ago when my wife and I were in England. We just flew back yesterday. Lovely man, Lawrence Freeman. He and I did a workshop here several years back. A Benedictine monk and a wonderful Dharma teacher within the Christian tradition. In fact, it was here, in fact, when we were leading this workshop a few years back. He said the greatest gift one person can offer to another is our attention. And of course he knows, we all know, that sometimes people need more than attention. They need food, they need guidance, they need education, they need a myriad of things. A mother knows that for a child. A child needs much more than attention. But if the attention is there, the loving attention is there, everything else flows. So allow me to pause. I know we're going slowly through the slides, but allow me to pause here because I have to share with you one of my favorite words in the English language. And it's attention. Coming from the verb, of course, to attend. And then I'll take it back to the Latin. It comes from the Latin, means to tend to. Attend means to tend to. So to attend to somebody is to tend to that person, to tend to watch over, to look after, and care for. And that's all built into attention. So a mother attends to her child. Spouses attend to each other. Friends attend to each other. People with great hearts attend to the world. We attend to those where there's great strife and conflict, like Iraq, Afghanistan, Darfur, Sudan, Ethiopia. Unfortunately, the list goes on and on. But we attend to. And then from that flows whatever's necessary. So as soon as I say that, shamatha is all about training attention. But then, we have these other practices, the cultivation, we see it on the bottom, loving kindness, compassion, empathetic joy, equanimity. And so this is where the whole emotional balance, the opening of the heart, that we say, wait a minute, this is all attention. When you're cultivating loving kindness for another person, what are you doing? You're attending with an open heart. You're attending, and empathy comes quite naturally. It's an experiment you might want to try in the near future. To a stranger, for example, if you're waiting in the market, you could be attending to the person. You're maybe still a person or two away from the person at the cash register. You have nothing else to do, probably. You may not be on the cell phone. Attend to the person behind the cash register. Just attend closely. And I think it's very likely, at least on occasion, not every time, as you simply attend closely to someone, you may find your heart opening. Just by attending. William James, my beloved intellectual hero, said, for the moment what we attend to is reality. And when we're attending to each other, when we're truly attending to each other, the other becomes real for us. And when the other becomes real for us, what can we possibly do except for feel empathy? Just by attending to. So relaxation, attentional stability, the vividness of attention, three practices we'll look into again in more detail, three core shamatha practices that I've been introduced to many, many, but these three, just each one is a jewel, and the three together and the balancing among the three, it worked well. It worked well. So we'll go into that a bit. And then these loving kindness, compassion, empathetic joy, equanimity. That was the range of practices that we followed. Very briefly now, for some of you, especially who've attended any retreats with me, this is really old hat. But in terms of the attentional training, the shamatha itself, there are really two faculties you're cultivating. So this question, is there such a thing as a faculty of attention that can be trained and to which then you can apply to a myriad of tasks and so forth? From a Buddhist perspective, from a traditional Christian contemplative perspective, Hindu perspective, Taoist perspective, people have been doing this for 2,000 or 3,000 or 4,000 or 5,000 years. The answer is, you're still asking that question? Yeah, we figured this out one a long time ago. Yes, you can. We'll call one major aspect of attention, we'll call it mindfulness. In the traditional context within Buddhism, here's the meaning of mindfulness. It's the ability to sustain voluntary attention, that is, you're deliberately focusing your attention, continuously, that's where the stability comes in, upon a familiar object, one with which you become acquainted, like your breathing, your own mind, or what have you, without forgetfulness or distraction. So mindfulness is just the opposite of mindlessness. Mindfulness is just the opposite of forgetfulness, just the opposite of absent-mindedness. Mindfulness. And it has a powerful connotation of recollection in the Buddhist context. So we translate it as mindfulness. It's kind of an umbrella term. But mindfulness has a core theme of recollection, as in recollecting, 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 recollecting. So mindfulness may be retrospective, as in, what did you have for breakfast this morning? Oh, I remember. That was retrospective mindfulness, where you've directed your attention back into time and retrieved something and called it up. Something that was familiar because you were present when you were eating breakfast. Mindfulness can be present-centered. And here, for example, if you're attending to the inflow, the outflow of the breathing, you're not remembering in the past, you're not remembering something in the future, but you're maintaining an ongoing flow of recollectedness, recollectedness. It's as if reality itself and our brains and our bodies and so forth are continually kind of pulling attention apart. It's like we bring attention to the world and entropy immediately sets in. And mindfulness, as in recollection, is anti-entropy. It is the deliberate exertion of a very gentle but consistent effort to get your act together and hold it together, to collect your mind and sustain that collectedness. Now, the object that you're attending to may be very large. It may be very small. It may be relatively stable. It may be rapidly changing. But present-centered mindfulness is this ongoing flow of non-absent-mindedness, mindfulness. And then mindfulness can also be prospective. And that is, oh, when you get into your cars tonight, don't forget, turn on your lights. Simple, we're all used to that. But if you're very new to driving, then you might think, oh, what have I forgotten? Oh, yeah, I'm supposed to turn on my lights. So you remember to do something in the future, or be sure you lock your doors tonight when you go to bed, you know, the outside doors. That's prospective memory in advance. So mindfulness is very rich, and that is a quality of attention that is specifically, centrally cultivated in the practice of shamatha. One could stop there and say, well, isn't that pretty much it? One can say, it's pretty much it, but it needs some help. And the help is this quality of metacognition. This is the quality control. It's another faculty of awareness, and it's the ability to monitor the quality of your attention, or the state of your mind altogether, in shamatha practice, particularly attention, swiftly recognizing whether your attention has succumbed either to excitation, in other words, you're falling into fragmentation, agitation, distraction, recognizing that as soon as possible, so you can take the steps necessary to recollect your awareness. And you do it by relaxing more deeply. Rather than tightening up and scolding yourself and say, oh, I suck at as a meditator, I'll never get this, and I'll try harder, and that just, you know, wears out the mind. Rather relaxing, releasing the energy behind the turbulence. So when you see the mind has fallen into excitation, you breathe out, and you release the energy behind it, and the mind settles. Or sometimes the mind settles too much, and it falls into laxity or dullness. And this is where the mind is imploding. I just watched my grandson this evening. We were watching the film Yogis of Tibet. And he's 2.5 years old, so he wasn't following all that much of it. He kept on asking, where are the yogis? Where are the yogis? I said, they're coming, they're coming. He was giving a background of Tibet. Where's the yogis? Where's the yogis? And then the yogis came on, and he fell asleep. No, but it was so sweet to see him. And he was there, and he was sitting right next to me, and he's going, and Vesna asked him, are you meditating or falling asleep? He said, sleep. And then we made room for him on the couch, and then, and he was out within like 1 minute. Right? So what we could see in this little boy is he was succumbing to laxity. And what was happening is his awareness was imploding away from the television screen and the fascinating yogis that were appearing and talking and talking and talking. You know, he was imploding from that. He was imploding from the environment. And you could see his little eyes going. And so he wasn't distracted. He wasn't agitated. He was imploding. And we allowed him to implode because there was no reason to block it. And then he fell like a tree, you know. And he had a really nice nap. So that's when you let laxity follow its course. It goes from laxity to dullness to sleepiness to little boy snoring. But if you're trying to practice shamatha, or you'd like to actually snip that in the bud. And so when you fall into laxity, you note that you're losing the edge, that sharp edge, the clarity. Then you gently arouse your attention. You take a fresh interest. You elevate it up again. So this is like very much a classic metaphor actually from the Buddha, was like stringing tuning the strings on a lute. You string them too tight, they snap. And they don't sound good before they snap anyway. If they're too slack, then they don't snap, but it sounds really cruddy. So you continue tuning and tuning and tuning, and it gets to be finer and finer tuned as you continue in the practice. So those are the two faculties, and this was the bread and butter. This was the core elements of the mind that are cultivated in the practice of shamatha. Very briefly then, in sequence, and this, I think, Catherine Morrow, who's one of our alumni from the first retreat here, and I don't know that anybody else is. Oh, of course, James, sorry. James and Lori's here? Son of a gun, where's Lori? Oh, son of a gun, hi Lori. So Lori is all alumni for the first retreat. Well, I think they're extremely familiar with this. They got to know this much better than their address. The first theme is one of relaxing your body and mind profoundly, more and more deeply setting your body and mind at ease. Absolutely crucial, especially for people living in our 21st century. And now I don't even speak of East and West anymore. 100 years ago, you could say East is East, West is West, like Rudyard Kipling. Not now. I've traveled too much. I was in Mongolia this summer. Ulaanbaatar, they're driving like maniacs, like they've got to get across the town, you know, as fast as possible. It didn't matter whether they're New York City or Ulaanbaatar. It's modernity. And it's in Beijing, and it's in Rio de Janeiro, and it's in Sydney, and it's Bangkok. I was there this summer. It's not East or West anymore. It's modernity and still those lingering little pockets of very traditional society. Relaxation is absolutely central. Then stability, this is the continuity and coherence of attention. And then the vividness that is out of relaxation comes stability. And that's a durable stability because it's not coming because you're striving so hard and gripping, keeping touch at tight grip, you know, which a jet fighter pilot might do, an air traffic controller might do, a chess champion might do, keep a tight grip, really focused, and then be totally wasted after you've done that for a few hours. The stability that comes out of relaxation. Oh, we had people meditating 10, 12 hours a day. Some of them in, one of them just recently, what was he doing? 7-hour sessions. And coming out, and this was, we had some, I'll get to that a little bit later, but we had some people from the first retreat continuing on, and they're continuing on now, 7-hour sessions, 9-hour sessions. And they come out of that to take a break, get a bite to eat. But the thing is, they've been focusing like with impeccable, really focused, sustained, stable, clear attention for 7 hours. They take a break, fresh as a daisy. They're not stressed out. They're not tight. They're not drained. Like, whew, let's get a sandwich and go back in again. That's stability coming out of relaxation rather than stability coming like no pain, no gain. I'll try really hard and I'll get that little sucker. And so stability coming out of relaxation and then the vividness, this is the heightened awareness. It's luminous, it's bright, it's clear. The vividness of attention is the degree of, I draw this analogy from a television screen. The degree of brightness, we all have the knob, at least we used to. And when I was a kid, there was a brightness knob. You remember that? A brightness, resolution, we have that. How many pixels per square centimeter? Pixels, right? So high resolution. Focus. The television has to be in focus, otherwise your pixels and brightness doesn't matter because it's all blurry. So it's a very close metaphor, right, from a television set or an LCD screen. So those three qualities aren't exactly qualities of attention. It's unpacking the vividness of attention, and then it manifests qualitatively. How do you know when vividness is really being enhanced? Two ways. Qualitatively, you're able to discern more and more subtle events taking place that otherwise would have been beneath the threshold of your attention. They may go on for seconds at a time, but they're so quiet, a quiet murmuring of some experience coming in. You would never notice until the vividness is sensed, and then suddenly, oh, look at that. That's qualitative, and the other was temporal. And that is being able to discern, to know that you are aware of events that are taking place for like 1/5 of a second, 1/10 of a second, 1/20 of a second, 50 milliseconds. And so you find you're able to detect briefer and briefer and briefer events. Can this be cultivated? The answer is definitely yes. So we did three different techniques. I'll just be very brief here. Again, a lot of you are very, very aware of them. So the first, our baseline practice, the most inviting for many people, accessible, engaging, restful, soothing, healthy, good for body and mind practice is mindfulness of breathing. The practice, it can be taught in a myriad of ways. And I would often encourage people, especially at the beginning, forget about sitting up, lie down. Go into the supine position. In yoga is called the Shavasana. Emulate a corpse, lie on your back, and then just in a softly lit room, and then let your awareness come to rest in the field of tactile sensations, that's familiar, throughout your body, so not being pinpoint, not being really tightly focused, but diffuse, but present at the beginning, while focusing your attention especially on the respiration, the sensations arising with the in and out flow of the breathing. And then without trying to control your breathing in any way, simply observe each inhalation and exhalation, noting whether it is long or short. That winds up being enormously important. It sounds so simple. Oh, yeah, got it, I know that. So long, short, whatever. But actually, there's a real art to breathing. Quite interesting. We all think, hey, I've been breathing for a long time. I know how to do that. Been there, done it, you know. Yeah, we know how to breathe. A lot of people breathe right up here, up in the chest. The tummy is so tight. They're so stressed out. They're so like this. It's shallow and it's way up in the chest, especially, you know, if you're trying to hold your tummy in for whatever reason. It's not such a good idea. It might look good, but it's not good for your nervous system and not good for your whole presence in the body. Learning how to breathe in the sense of learning how to utterly release your voluntary control over the breathing and allow the breathing to happen. Allow it to flow in just as much as it's needed. Just flowing in effortlessly. And then the big deal is exhalation. Oh, the exhalation is really prime. Every exhalation, cherish it. As I say, there's only three things absolutely certain in life. Death, taxes, and the exhalation. There's no guarantee about the in-breath. One of these days, you know, it just won't happen. But the out-breath... Dead people can breathe out. You get one shot. and then that's it. But everybody gets the out-breath, you know? And so to say, wow, the out-breath, and you feel it, and you just completely release into it, and you completely release and release and release all the stuff in your mind, the mental debris, and you're releasing and releasing like you don't have a care in the world, and you're just trusting reality without making any bifurcation of inside, outside, body, not body. Just, I'm trusting reality that if I'm to be given an in-breath, it's going to come, and it's going to be given. I don't need to snatch it. I don't need to suck. I don't need to exert effort. I can utterly release the breath with utter abandon. And unless it happens to be that special moment when it is, in fact, your last breath, apart from that one time, the in-breath will happen. And it flows in effortlessly. And when you allow yourself simply to receive the in-breath without grabbing at it, just to receive it, reality offering you the in-breath, then you'll get just as much as you need. You won't gasp, you won't take too much, you won't take too little, you won't take it too fast or too slow. You won't enforce or superimpose a rhythm on it. You'll just say, I trust this breathing process. My body, in relationship with the environment, knows how to breathe better than I do. And so I'm going to let it happen. And although I can influence it, and I can very easily influence it, I'm going to do my best just to let it be and let the body breathe. It's beautiful. So helpful. Especially with each out-breath, relax your body and mind more and more deeply, but without losing the vividness of attention. So that's basically it. We had people doing that 8 hours a day was very common. Some people 6, some people 10 or 12. Here's an extraordinary practice, again, some of you have been exposed to. Technically, it's called settling the mind in its natural state. What it is observing the space of the mind and whatever arises within it. And the space of the mind is very selective. And that is, if we had a bit more time, and we don't have much, it's already 8 o'clock, but if this were a meditation retreat, then I would give you the cook's tour of your different fields of experience. And that would be to, I'll just talk about it rather than really trying to do it right now, but just quieting the mind and then directing the full force of your attention to the visual field. And say, that's all I'm interested in right now. I'm just going to focus on the visual. And be utterly present with that. And then close the eyes and direct your full attention to the auditory field, the domain of experience, the sounds. And just be attending there. And then, okay, now just the tactile. And I won't need to block my ears, but I'll be sitting in a quiet place, close the eyes, and then just be focusing on the tactile. Sensations of heat and cold, of pressure, of tingling, of motion, of itching, whatever it may be in the body, and just being present there, just tactile. And then if there's any fragrance, any taste, go for it. If not, fine, we have 3. And then pose a question. Now that I have one by one surveyed my domain, you're like a king or a queen who has 5 provinces, and you've checked out each of them, one by one, oh, that's the visual province, that's the auditory, and so forth. Then you ask yourself, did I miss anything? Is there anything else that's arising up to meet me, that reality is serving up, reality is dishing up from moment to moment? Is there anything else that I've missed here? Not in terms of inference or figuring out, but in terms of immediately reality offering something up. Did I miss anything? Oh, yeah. Thoughts. You don't see them. You can look at the brain. You don't see any thoughts. You can look at behavior. You don't see any thoughts. You can talk with somebody and you can hear what they say, but you don't know what they're thinking. Sometimes people are saying one thing and thinking something quite different. It happens. But thoughts are something we immediately observe, especially when you start opening your eye of what's called simply mental perception. There's nothing occult here, nothing weird or strange or mystical. It's just a 6th door of perception to observe whatever thoughts are arising. And so you direct your attention now to the 6th domain of immediate experience. And what arises there? Discursive thoughts, internal chit-chat. Or it may be directed thought, memories cropping up, mental images, bananas and pineapples, and your mother's face and railroad, and all the images that come up, desires, How do you know that you desire something? Do you only know when your body is in motion? Or can you be sitting quietly? Yeah, that was enough. To notice before the hand goes out for the water, my throat's getting a little bit dry. That'd be nice to have some moisture coming in. Can you note that before the hand is going out? And then, can you, in noting the desire coming up, can you then just bring in metacognition and see, I see the desires coming up, helpful or not helpful? Like if that were vodka. Could that help my Dharma talk a little bit here, my presentation? Help? Maybe a little snort? Maybe not. Maybe not. So when you monitor the desire, then you can actually have a desire about the desire. Is that something I want to follow through with? Let it go into an attention, intention, and intention give rise to actual the hand going out and drinking. Or is this one, that's desire, but vodka now, time is not good. Not good timing. We'll wait for the vodka until everybody's gone home and bend the elbow. So desires come up. We don't see them, we don't hear them, but we can immediately perceive them. And emotions. Emotions. Right now, bored, excited, happy, sad, sleepy, wide awake. What's the mental state? What's the emotional state? How do we know that? We don't have to carry a mirror and say, how do I feel? You know before you look, right? But it's an ability to hone. Well, all of these, and that was a short list. There are a lot of other things going on in the space of the mind. In this practice, you select out of the six domains of experience, you select one. And it's the one that's left over when you fall asleep and you begin dreaming. When you're dreaming, all your other five senses shut down. They've gone dormant. Right? So unless you really jostle someone, the person dreaming is not aware. I've had lucid dreams, and one of the startling things about having a lucid dream, knowing you're dreaming while you're dreaming, is you have no immediate experience of your body lying in bed at all. It's really weird to know that only by inference. I have a body in the dream, and I'm aware of that, and I know this is a dream, and I'm moving my hands in the dream, extending my limbs and so forth. I'm seeing other dream people. This is an immediate experience. I know this is happening, but since I know I'm dreaming, I must have a body lying in bed someplace. It's very weird to have to infer the existence of your own body. That's exactly what you do. You infer it because you know you're dreaming, and you're not dead. Dead, then you don't have a body anymore, at least in the Bardo. And so that which is left over when you're dreaming, that's the sixth domain. And think about your dreams. Is there any emotion you can't experience in a dream? Is there any mental image that cannot arise when you're dreaming? Any thought you can't think when you're dreaming? Any desire you can't experience when you're dreaming? My answer to those questions is no. Pretty much anything I can experience in the daytime, I can get the virtual reality of a dream to replicate it or do something similar, a facsimile. And it's all taking place purely in the sixth domain of experience because your sight is down, your hearing is down, tactile sensation down, smell and taste, all dormant. Until somebody jostles you or you simply wake up and then they're activated. That's what you're focusing on in this practice, the space of the mind, the arena, the stage on which the dreams play out, thoughts, images, mental emotions, desires. You attend to the space and you attend to whatever arises within it. You leave your eyes open. I won't go into why that's done right now. Rest your gaze, your visual gaze in front of you without focusing on anything, just resting it in space. And then your attention you direct to the space of the mind, whatever mental events, processes, states that arise in it. And then you arrest your awareness, and this is the core instruction. You arrest your awareness without distraction. So you don't let the wild stallion of your mind leap the fence and go into some other domain of experience. Like attending to the visual or the auditory or getting interest in your body. You keep it there you sustain the flow of your attention without distraction. That is, without being carried away by any of the discursive thoughts, attending to the referent of the thought, as opposed to just the event of the thought itself arising here and now, and without grasping onto any of them. You're simply present with whatever arises in the space of the mind, but without fusing your mind into it, identifying with it, grasping onto it, and then launching off to the referent of the thought. You're like luminous space, attending to the subspace of the mind and whatever arises within it. It's a spectacular practice. We had people doing this for up to 12 hours a day for 90 days, 100 days. It dredges the psyche. It does some pretty spectacular things. And one of the remarkable aspects of it, it's a glorious discovery. And this is done in the Christian tradition. It's done in the Vedanta tradition very strongly, beautifully done in the Vedanta tradition. And then in Tibetan Buddhism especially, this practice is done. It's done in the Zen tradition as well. So again, nobody has a monopoly on this practice at all. It's too good for any one tradition to say, oh, we own it. You have to become a Buddhist to do this. Nobody can do that. The remarkable thing about this practice is you can really enhance your metacognitive awareness of whatever is taking place in the mind. That is a skill that gets sharper and sharper, higher resolution qualitatively, higher resolution temporally. So a fleeting little desire can go, and you notice it. A thought, a number of people in the first and the second retreat would say, as they're really settling into this and the flow is going on, they would, and I've had this experience myself, they would say, I was settling the mind in its natural state and attending very closely, and I would see a thought about to arise and then not fully arise and just slip back into the space of the mind. So an embryonic thought, which never got into words, but they would feel it's going surging and then dissolving back in. Really amazing. So just the ability, I mean, the Delphic oracle, know thyself, this is really powerful for that, for knowing the whole mental dimension of your being here. But what was remarkable about this practice, it's been known for centuries, is that the sheer quality of attention, that it's very attentive, discerning, clear, but non-reactive, non-grasping, not manipulating, non-controlling, but just being present, luminously, clearly, discerningly, but without cringing with aversion, without leaping with desire and craving, just being present, it heals the mind. It heals the mind. And having said that, that's not quite right. It's not that this practice does something to you, like you got it from me as a teacher and I teach it now, what I taught you is healing the mind. That's not quite right. The practice, the quality of awareness being brought to the mind, so clear, so present, discerning, but non-reactive, that allows the healing capacity of your own mind to manifest. So you're not getting the healing ability from a teacher. You're not getting it from Buddhism, and you're not getting it from a technique. The technique is an enormous amount of not doing, which allows the healing capacity of your own mind to manifest. And then so many people found this to be the case. The tangles, the knots, the constrictions, the binding up, the neuroses, fixations that we can get caught up into. They loosen, and dissolve. Quite extraordinary. I've had a number of conversations by now over the years, and again in this last retreat that ended just maybe 2 weeks ago, with people working as psychiatrists and psychotherapists, clinical psychotherapists and MD psychiatrists. We all agreed, especially those who'd done this practice a lot, with this professional training, which I don't have in mental health care, what a marvelous combination this practice could be with professionally trained psychiatrists or psychotherapists, because they're bringing in a wealth of experience from the Western tradition, in some cases decades of experience of themselves with therapy, working with people with abuse, with trauma, with adversity, and just a wide array of psychological disorders, where they may not by themselves be able to heal the mind, but working with a very skilled, contemplative, experienced therapist, work together where the client is engaging in such practice, discovering the healing capacities of the mind for him or herself, and then working together with the therapist to help through the bumpy spots, where we get stuck, where we can kind of go nose down. There's enormous potential there. So I was talking with our resident psychologist for the second retreat, wonderful man from Maine, about my age, about 30, 35 years of experience as a psychotherapist, and we were just kind of envisioning, now we have, you know, a number of schools of psychotherapy, and there's personality psychology, there's affective psychology, social psychology, cognitive psychology. We should have a new branch. It's called contemplative psychology. But the psychologist, him or herself, has some really robust, sustained training in contemplative practice, with or without a religious connotation. That's their choice. But then brings that, unifies that with their own formal training. So you attend to the thoughts and you just let them be. You could control them, but you don't. Then finally, what I think a lot of us agreed was probably the most profound of all the practices, the simplest of all the practices. And like it's like standing on the top of Mount Everest with no air, auxiliary air supply. You can breathe, but the air is pretty darn thin. This practice is called shamatha without a sign or shamatha without an object, where you just rest. First of all, with your visual gaze, again, you just let it rest in the space in front of you. It's an integral aspect of the practice. And then you simply rest in awareness of awareness, with no other object, no interest in anything appearing to the mind, no interest in any thoughts, no interest in anything, any appearances or object to the mind at all, but just resting in the knowing of knowing, the awareness of awareness. We're so discreet, that we keep our little insanity to ourselves. But if there were a loudspeaker there, it'd be going, blah, 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 blah. And we can't turn it off. I mean, you can try. But it's oddly difficult to get the mind to just shut up for even 1 minute. Would you just be quiet for 1 minute when I'm not deep in non-REM sleep? Lots of luck. Well, this develops that ability, that when you actually want to be quiet, you can. And when you want to think, you can. But you don't obsessively spew one thought out after another, most of them complete waste of time and completely exhausting. So when people got good at this practice, we had people, I had a lot to do. I was meeting with people 4 hours a day in the retreat, but I was down to 4 or 5 hours of sleep a night and doing fine and dandy. There was one woman there, an MD. She's meditating on the average, sleeping on the average 2 hours a night, waking up at 1 o'clock, 2 in the morning, and bright-eyed and bushy-tailed. Just start meditating 12, 13 hours a day, and really balanced. I saw her the whole way through, and I was kind of watching her closely as the instructor. Is she going to burn out here? No, she did fine all the way through, because she wasn't exhausting herself with this obsessive spewing forth of thoughts and then the compulsive grasping onto thoughts. So what are the trait effects? What are the lingering effects when you're not in meditation? An enhanced psychological immune system, the mind not so prone to falling into irritation, impatience, anxiety, craving, and a myriad of other imbalances. You're healthier. Mental and physical pliancy, a high degree of control of attention, that is, if you wish direct attention, you can. And an ongoing sense of well-being was not uncommon. So we come back to research questions I have. Can such training, this whole array of shamatha practice, can they decrease stress and enhance efficiency for everyday multitasking? My very dear stepdaughter is here, Sarah, and so she has, like I'm sure many of you have experienced, a young child, our little grandson. Having a 2.5-year-old in the house means you will be multitasking. You don't have any choice in the matter. You can't just tell your, okay, boy, now be quiet. Freeze, and I'm going to do one thing at a time. But freeze, and I'm going to do one thing at a time. That's not happening. And there are a lot of occupations where multitasking is just built in. You do have to attend to multiple things, and your mind is hopping around like a monkey jumping from one wind to the next. Is there some way we can do that without getting wiped out? That it can be more supple. The mind can move, but not be fatigued, not get worn out with a lot of wear and tear in the process. Creativity, does this practice have anything to do with creativity? I think you can ask the 70 people in the retreat, it has a lot to do with creativity. Problem solving, athletics. We had one person in the first retreat who was very, very keen on sports psychology. Could this be helpful in especially the fine-tuned of sports like golf, like tennis, like other ones that take some finesse, basketball, and not being a 400-pound, guard in football. I don't think that needs a lot of finesse. Basically just like that. Shamatha might be helpful for that, maybe not. But for the ones that have more delicacy to them, finesse, more of a psychology, could that be helpful? Interpersonal relationships. Helpful, not helpful? These, I think, are really important questions. This matrix of practices, do they improve emotional health and well-being or not? Is it a good thing to develop attention in that way? Is it helpful? Is it enhance mental balance and well-being and health to spend 8-10 hours a day Is that good during the retreat? Are the lingering effects helpful or not helpful? And how much, this was a big question that came up in the retreats, how much training is needed each day and over time, and how durable are the effects? When you have nothing else to do, then you can meditate 6 to 12 hours a day. That's what people were doing. But when the retreat's over and you're back, most people, about 80% of the people that went back to their lives, their families, their jobs, and so forth, well, for them to maintain the abilities, the benefits they derive from the retreat, how much is needed? You know, how much is lost? What I told people in both retreats is the chances are if you go back to a very active way of life, you probably will not be able to sustain the same level of attention stability and vividness that you did when you're practicing 8 hours a day. But for these other practices of cultivating the heart, of empathy, of loving kindness, and so forth, you may actually find that you're able to cultivate these somewhat in solitude, in meditation, in retreat, but when you come out into the world and you're no longer visualizing people so much in a meditative practice, but you're attending to them. Attending to people when they're in bad moods, when they're behaving sometimes badly, or when they're behaving wonderfully, but just life. Or you're watching the news and you're seeing what's happening in distant places, like we're all clairvoyant when we watch the news, and seeing things that are taking place even right now. Because we all know this. But can this actually enhance our active engagement with the world, with our families, our colleagues at work, surrounding society, and then the large surrounding society by way of media? Can these qualities of the heart, can they actually continue to be cultivated and enhanced when you come out of the retreat and engage? Enormously important questions. The four sublime virtues of the heart, there they are again, just loving kindness, compassion, empathetic joy, equanimity. And then these balance each other. This is a whole talk in and of itself, but I'm going to be very brief now. But I would call them our four best friends. I say when you leave here, you can have four best friends. When you leave this retreat, you'll have four best friends. And it is these four qualities of loving kindness and so forth. And amongst them, they balance each other. So, for example, empathetic joy, taking delight in others' joys, their successes, their virtues, but just taking delight, also in one's own joys and virtues and so forth, this can give rise to just taking so much delight one just starts having a whole lot of desire and craving. It can happen. So then empathetic joy just goes a bit astray. Well, when you just start getting kind of just fixated, a bit obsessive, kind of craving, just get caught up in more trivial desires and so forth, which among the four immeasurables, these four qualities, helps to balance you out again, restore your equilibrium, restore your sanity. And in fact, it's loving kindness. I don't have time to elaborate on that right now. It's a very gentle and very effective practice. When you practice equanimity, that can give rise, when it goes astray, to kind of a cold indifference, a detachment, a disengagement, where you've gone so deeply into your meditation, the mind is so calm, that you just find you're not caring much about other people. Their joys or sorrows, you say, well, that's not me. Somebody else. So kind of like just a withdrawal. That's clearly not a part of any genuine spiritual practice. So if that happens, of course that can happen whether or not you're meditating. Sometimes, again, I know that it can happen for healthcare professionals, happy people in social work, it can happen for educators. But after a while, you've just had it. And it's not anybody's fault. It's just, you're burnt out. You're burnt out. And you say, I can't do anymore. I've dealt with so many other people's problems. I've been so caring. I've been so engaged. And they've sucked the life out of me. And I've had it. I just can't care anymore. We can understand, sympathize. But you don't want to get stuck there. How can we bring the life back, the warmth back to the heart, that the heart is large enough that we can once again truly attend to? And it's compassion. Compassion brings the warmth back. But now if you're cultivating compassion, if we really attend closely to the miseries in so many parts of the world, and it's not only large locations, but it's the fifth story of the cottage hospital. A friend of ours died there. And that was some years back. Well, there are people right now dying on the fifth story of cottage hospital. We attend to them closely, and then we consider the magnitude, the range of suffering that people are experiencing right now, and other sentient beings, not only human beings. And just how it seems like we're so intent on perpetuating our suffering. Just out of delusion, out of confusion, getting things wrong. Parents not knowing how to parent their children, raise their children, children just not knowing how to deal with reality, the trials and tribulations of adolescence, and the list goes on and on. But sometimes, or if we can just watch politics and watch, you know, what's happening in the world, we can just think, oh, jeez. Just fall into despair and think, ah, it's just too much. It's just, what do we do if we just fall into despair? Empathetic joy. To balance out. To balance out. To attend to other aspects of reality that uplift our spirits. And then finally, attachment and aversion, when we're just carving up, oh, I like these people, I don't like these people. How to make the heart, our empathy, even. In the sense of equanimity, in the sense of impartiality. That we attend to each sentient being, each person, as absolutely unique, precious, worthy of our attention, worthy of finding the happiness that each one seeks, worthy of finding freedom from suffering that we all seek, and having a heart open. So those are the four qualities. These were our four best friends. And I must say it was an enormous delight to me in both of the retreats. It was such a sense of deep gratification and delight for me to see for almost all the people, almost all the time. This was not a utopia, so it wasn't all, you know, roses all the way through. But almost all the people, almost all the time, really treated each other very decently, in many cases with kindness, with empathy. Happened again and again in both retreats that someone would fall ill and immediately there's another meditator there looking after the person. And then calling, if somebody else needed, then calling in. Happened again and again and again. And when both of the retreats ended, and I would say equally, when both of the retreats came to the end, we had a gentle going into the retreat with people coming in waves of six people, and then everybody's in. We had measurements towards the beginning, towards the middle, towards the end. And then the last 5 days of each retreat, and we broke silence, we shattered silence, and people would talk through the meals. They pretty much talk all the anytime they wanted to for the last 5 days. But the quality of conversation, to see the warmth, the kindness, the friendliness, with no one excluded. Some people had a lot of problems, and sometimes it manifested in behavior. But at the end of the day, nobody left. Two retreats, 70 people, nobody left. That was quite astonishing for the scientists. They were sure people would leave. We were kind of figuring, well, how many could leave and we'd still have a project left? That's why we're thinking 30 people, even if 10 leave, we still have a science. We still have 20. That's still good. But if we started with 20 and only having 10, boy, that would be dicey. You know, it's a pretty small number. Nobody left. And no one was excluded. When we all came out and were speaking with each other, no one was excluded. Even people who had been very... people here and there, difficult on occasion. They weren't excluded. So that was enormously rewarding. There was our meditation place. It was finished just a year ago last May, and brand new, and we basically filled the place. And the scientists were down in the basement. They were in the dungeon. And they were working 14-hour days, a team of 5 or 6 scientists working in the first retreat all the time. Because we'd have a wave of 6 people coming in, 2 days of measurements. What was it, about 8 hours a day, I think. 2 full days of measurement for each person in twin labs, state-of-the-art EEG, behavioral studies, empathy, metacognition, attention studies, blood samples, saliva samples. 2 full days. They'd come in, 2 full days of measurement, and then they're in. As soon as that wave was finished, the next wave of 6 people would come in, 2 full days, boom, boom, boom. 5 people working 14 hours a day. All the people had moved in, all the 37 people in the first retreat, all had been measured, they're now all in place. Then comes the control group. And the control group, this is the other group of 33 people that will be in the second retreat. We flew them in from England, Mexico, Canada, all over the place. We flew them 3 times. A lot of airline expense there. We flew them up there. It took about 4 or 5 days out of their lives. They would fly in from London, for example, fly to Denver, take the trip up to Red Feather Lakes, our nearest place. They would plunk down, have 1 day to acclimate, because we're at 8,000 feet there, 2 full days of testing, and then down to Denver and back to where they came from. And they did that 3 times. Well, as soon as the meditators, our meditating group, as soon as they'd finished their first set of measurements, the very next day, the first wave of the control group is being flown in. And then wave after wave of the 33 people from the control group, they're coming in, 14-hour day, 14-hour day. The control group finishes their first set of measurements. As soon as they're finished, we're about halfway through the retreat. It's now time for the meditators to have their second intermediate set of 2 days of measurement. Every day, 14 hours a day, boom, boom, boom. As soon as they're finished, time for the control group, fly them in. It's time for their intermediate measurements. As soon as they're finished, then we're towards the end of the retreat, the meditators have 2 full days. As soon as they're finished, the control group is flown in for the third time and 2 full days, each one, 33 people. So these scientists work at least as hard as any of the meditators. The hottest, most enthusiastic, eager beaver meditators were only putting in 12-hour days. The scientists, every doggone day, were putting in 14. So we were in this together. It was quite extraordinary. But that was our place. It was lovely. We had the Shambhala Mountain Center staff treated us wonderfully well. And then to give you a very brief, I mean, this is, I can't, and will definitely, now we're going to wrap up pretty quickly here. But I wanted to give you some of the science and then tell you a little bit of the outcome. Because now all the data are collected. And it's terabytes of data. And it's over 10,000 journal entries. So I'll just pause there. How do we measure these people? The scientists were pretty much 50-50, neuroscientists and psychologists. And then among neuroscientists and psychologists, they were pretty much 50-50, affective neuroscientists or affective psychologists and cognitive neuroscientists and cognitive psychologists. So the cognitive side was to measure attention, mindfulness, metacognition, vigilance, mental stuff. And then the affective neuroscientist psychologists, they're studying empathy, emotional regulation, emotional balance, loving kindness, compassion, pro-social skills and decision-making. So they're studying that. So it's very, very rich. It has nothing to do with Alan Wallace as a meditative instructor. It has nothing to do with meditation. Give me a break. They're taking, you know, this is Club Med in the Rocky Mountains. So of course they're going to get better. But for those of you who've been on vacation, you probably didn't find that day by day you're getting happier and happier and happier. You probably didn't find that your attention skills were improving as you're lying on the beach drinking your margarita. So already some clear indications, something here was happening that you don't get just by going on vacation. So that was interesting. So those studies were done. Again, for those who know psychology, I won't try to unpack these. We're just about wrapping up here. But the Stroop test, very famous Stroop test, the Flanker test. So what we had was a balancing act here. That is, these very well-known, time-tested, scientifically validated measures of attention, empathy, and so forth, for the scientists, they had to be part of their tradition. They just couldn't come up with a whole bunch of new measurements nobody had ever heard of and say, we tried these. All their fellow psychologists, their peers would say, what's that? What was that? That's not us. And so you can't do that. On the other hand, all of these measurements, without exception, were devised for people living active way of lives, you know, just totally normal with no training at all. Well, then how can we measure what's happening if you meditate 8 hours a day for 2 months when the measurements were designed for ordinary people with no training at all? Obviously, that's going to be a disconnect pretty quickly. So we had to be innovative to come up with new measures that would really keep track of the meditators as their minds are transforming, to keep track with them from week to week, month to month. So we had to be innovative, but not too innovative. And we had to be traditional to really be part of the psychological tradition, but not too traditional. The scientists did a marvelous job there. They really were smart. So here are some of the attentional blink. That's a famous one. And then very sophisticated EEG measures were done. So that was part of the traditional stuff. The emotion potential startle, very classic. That was I had experience of that myself. Film recall tasks of their responding about their emotions and so forth when they're seeing an emotionally charged film. So lexical decision, empathy, rating difficult marital interactions. Levinson, Bob Levinson at Berkeley, classic study. So it was really quite a brilliant array of measures the scientists brought together. And again, this is the short list. Here are more. I won't even try here. But for the psychologists here, you can look through that. Paul Ekman, I know very well, is emotional experience questionnaire. And again, for psychologists, feast. It's a feast. You know, you can see what was being done there. This was a very, very rich and diverse practice. And then what was among the things they did for their 2 full days of measurements, among them, what they would do would be 12 minutes of practicing shamatha. And then they would have EEG on, and they would be having other measurements going on while they're doing practicing shamatha. And for another 12 minutes, practicing compassion and loving kindness. And this, again, is part of tradition because Antoine Lutz, who works with Richard Davidson at the University of Wisconsin, has used this. And so, again, tapping into some of the finest studies of meditation done recently. A few of the many issues, the questions, the difficulties, I think I won't try to read all of that, but a lot of thought went into it. The scientists had a fundamental challenge. Meditation, our own mental experience, qualities of empathy, they are qualitative. They're subjective. How do you measure that quantitatively? By studying brainwaves or your reaction time on a video with respect to a video screen. How do you really measure empathy? How do you measure compassion? So they really had their work cut out for them. And we knew this was a pioneering effect. 50 years from now, we hope people will look back on our study of this year and saying, wow, is that primitive? We're hoping they'll be thinking that, because that will show how much we've progressed. But this was really, this was a milestone of just the quality of science. And then 70 participants, the weightless crossover control group, how much intelligence and ingenuity went into it. Interesting things like the projection onto the teacher. An issue. It happens for therapists, I'm sure. Well, does it happen in a three-month retreat with a meditation teacher? I think it's called transference. I learned a lot about transference. The answer is yes. How do you deal with it? The whole interface between the scientific side, which is very secular and very materialistic, and I'm not secular and I'm not materialistic. I'm religious. And many of the people in the retreat were religious. So how do you bring those together without it being a conflict? Well, we did. We did. And Cliff Sand and I are our dearest friends. He's a hardcore materialist. Everything just the brain, epiphone of the brain. You know, that's the way it is. And I just tell him, Cliff, you are so wrong. He kind of smiles at me and says, let's just hold the question. And I said, I can dig that, you know. So there we were. Our worldviews were really, really different. And we just loved each other so much and respected each other so much. Everything was fine. If you have love and respect, piece of cake. That's what happened. So many, many issues there. And finally, that's at the end of the first retreat. Our happy campers. And it was really lovely. And about, and so that's the final slide, we'll bring it to an end. We had 70 people, about 20% of them either are right now or soon will be going into a sustained retreat to continue and go deeper and deeper in the practice. So they've rented a house in Crestone, another couple, I just got an email this morning, another couple has rented another house in Crestone. We have people have found a house in Mexico. Others are taking a brief break, then go back in January looking for other places in Mexico or elsewhere in the United States. So about 20% got so inspired by the practice from their own experience, not because I'm a clever teacher or they have so much faith in something else, but just derive so much experience and say, I've got to go deeper here. Just want to devote themselves to it. And many, many of the others came out so motivated at the end. They said, I am resolving it's going to be 4 hours a day. I'll practice 4 hours a day. I'll practice 6 hours a day. I'm going to retire in 2 years, and I'm building a cabin so I can really follow through with this as soon as I retire. So that was very gratifying as well. So we'll have a lot more information, even within a few months. Then Cliff Sarin will have analyzed a lot more of the behavioral data and then this massive amount of physiological data, all the spit that people had to spit out. They got really tired of it, by the way. You think spit would be pretty innocuous. I heard from a lot of people they got really tired of spitting into vials. Apparently there's something really, I don't know, vile about that. I didn't like it. And the blood and the blood and the blood. I offered to serve everybody Bloody Marys at the beginning. They didn't think that was funny at all. But that's the upshot of it. But I was so inspired. This will be my final comment, and then we will stop. Just have a couple minutes. But it's important for me to remember now when the data are all collected, we'll have follow-up. 5 months after the first retreat, follow-up. 5 months after the second retreat, they're going to be sending computers all over the world, and they'll be doing measurements on their laptop computers, and there'll be questionnaires to see, well, what's it like 5 months after? Any effects still, or is it now just a memory? So, in fact, all the data have not been accumulated, but most of it. But we just didn't know. You know, last January, we knew we'd making this massive commitment. Shambhala, the people at Shambhala Mountain Center, especially the marketing guy, were petrified that, you know, nobody would sign up, that they would have allocated that great big building, and they have a big debt on it, and nobody would show up. Or they'd show up and they'd find that I so suck as a Dharma, as a teacher, they'd just leave. You know, they'd flee for the hills after a week and say, hey, get me out of here. They didn't, who knew? You know? And then we didn't know whether people just get crazy. We didn't know yet whether people would just get so bored, stiff, they couldn't stand it anymore and just start throwing frisbees. Or considering we had half men and half women. I don't need to finish that sentence. We didn't know. You know, we just didn't know. The scientists were taking, frankly, a big risk. You can shatter your career in something like this. I never took any risk at all, because if I completely blow it as a Dharma teacher, then I get to do what I love most and just go back and meditate. So I was in a win-win situation, but I think I was the only one. And then these poor meditators, some of them only been on a one-week retreat, now it's a three-month date. That means it's a pretty big commitment. The two retreats went really marvelously. They did, not without problems. We had a big big louse scare in the second one. We thought maybe everybody is contaminated with head lice. And so we swept through the whole building. We cleaned all the laundry. We took out all our meditation cushions. We washed all our clothes. Everybody got checked repeatedly for head lice. Everybody like going monkeys, like, you know, going through everybody's head. And because we saw some lice. And as a meditation instructor, I think, oh, great, just what we need. Lice all over the place. So you're... It's hard. And that really raised questions. And so, but everybody gathered. We had this big thing, like the place may be infested with lice, you know. And most people had long hair. I mean, a few bald, but not many. And so everybody ganged together. This was like 1-2 weeks into the retreat. Everybody said, we may have lice everywhere. So everybody then took everything out. No clothing that hadn't been sealed away. Everything went off to wash. We washed all the linen. We vacuumed. We did everything, top down, everything. Everybody dropped their meditation for a full day. And it was wonderful to see the camaraderie, the warmth, the lightness, the cheerfulness. Everybody did this. And we cleaned the place spick and span. And then the bright young woman who was our internal coordinator, she got some more of the lice because we found more. And I thought, oh, great, now we've got to bomb the place. You know, this really heavy, toxic poison. I thought, oh, boy. It's kind of like for a meditation instructor, how many people are going to be allergic to the poison? This is going to screw up their whole retreat. So talk about don't know what's going to happen. This bright young gal, she got some of our lice and shipped them off to the lice center of North America. Harvard. I assume you knew I meant Harvard. I don't mean that's where all the lice congregated, although there may be a fair number there, but they are world experts on lice. And we had the local MD. This is what really got me going at the beginning. We had some, we found some, and we took it to the local MD in our nearby town, and she put them under the microscope. He said, it's a louse. I said, oh, great. So then we clean the whole place, and then we find more lice. This bright young woman, Heather, then sent our lice off to Harvard. And Harvard looked at them, and they emailed us right back. They're book lice. This was music to our ears. Because book lice eat books very slowly. They don't eat whole books at a time. They just nibble. Tiny bit. Most offices, probably in this building here, there are book lice. They're innocuous. They don't get on people. They don't like people. They prefer books over blood. Go figure, you know, but everybody has their own taste. And so then there was no problem. We didn't have to. We just live with the book lice, no problem. And so everything got eased up. So it was just delightful to see how everybody was so resilient, dealt with the problems arising, and it inspired me to think, wow, people really did get benefit. It was so clear from my perspective, from their perspective. Now we're just seeing, it was the science good enough to measure what we definitely know happened. And people's attention skills definitely got better. Metacognitive awareness, definitely better. Greater empathy, no question about it. Shifting of priorities, no question about it. And so I came out of the first retreat thinking that was a success, and then I zipped all over the place for the summer. Came back for the second one. The second one is smooth like silk. It went so smoothly. I don't know why, but it was just so easy. Beautiful. I never heard a single word of disharmony. Not one. In 33 people in a pressure cooker for 3 months, I never even heard a word of disharmony. Marvelous to see. And then the joy, the lightness, and so forth at the end. And I thought, this is really worth doing. And so this year and these two projects were really kind of a linchpin or a pivotal for my just envisioning, shall this whole notion of the Santa Barbara Institute for Consciousness Study, is that worth doing, or shall I just kind of keep it as an idea and let it kind of fade away quietly into the sunset? And with these two retreats under our belt, I thought, come to the conclusion, boy, those retreats were really helpful. And if we can make them really economically feasible, you know, really keep the cost down as much as possible, find a place near Santa Barbara, and be able to hold every year like a three-month retreat, maybe shorter, of course, shorter retreats also. And then if we have continue to have 20% of people coming out of a three-month retreat saying, this is my vocation, this is what I want to do, I want to achieve enlightenment. I don't want to just achieve shamatha, that's just getting a supple mind. I want to go all the way. That we are embracing them. So when they come out of that, we say, oh, great, here's your cottage. It'll cost you $10 a day for room and board. That's my hope. $15 maximum. Then you pay for utilities. But we cover them. And if they don't have $15 a day, we find benefactors. And I know some benefactors. And they say, look, we have this young person, or middle age, whatever age. This person is very dedicated, strong motivation, good discipline, wants to just devote him or herself to Dharma. Can you spare $15 a day for this person? I can find people like that. The answer is yes. So even if they don't have $15 a day, still support them. And then support them if they want to be in for 1 year, 3 years, 5 years, in until they achieve enlightenment. Support them. And then, whenever it's suitable, seems feasible, bring in the science, let the science continue to roll, and then cultivate a generation, especially of younger people. I'm too old, I'm an old geezer here. But especially younger people in their 20s and 30s, to get a really solid basis in contemplative practice and get a professional training in psychology or neuroscience, and then cultivate what His Holiness Dalai Lama calls hybrids. People who are really professionally trained, deeply trained in meditation, and really well trained in one of the mind sciences, and start a new branch of neuroscience and psychology. Contemplative science. That's it. I now think this is really worthwhile. And that people could benefit, that people would come. And I'd love to see it take place near Santa Barbara, my home. That's what we did. Thank you so much for coming. It's 9 o'clock. I think we probably all could hit the sack. My wife and I just got back from England, so I'm ready to hit the sack. When there are questions, discussions, let's meet again. We can have that. We'll have retreat starting in February. So have a good night. Hope to see you soon.